Hi, friends. Welcome to the By Faith podcast. I'm your host, Christine Hoover, and I'm so glad you're here. Each week this season, I'm talking with a guest about how they are pursuing devotion to God by fighting sin and learning to delight in Him. Through their stories, we're learning how we too can fight for wholehearted allegiance to King Jesus. Friends, as you heard me talk about last week, my new book, With All Your Heart, goes right along with this theme, and now is a great time to pre-order the book because when you pre-order the book and input your purchase information on my website, christinehoover.net, you get an automatic download of the ebook version. That means you can begin reading it right now, today. In addition, you'll get a signed book plate for when your paper copy arrives and a study guide. The book is really meant to be digested and discussed in community, so the study guide will help you and your friends do just that. And guys, if you pre-order before February 10th, you'll automatically gain access to an online book club that I will be hosting, where I'll offer insights and mini courses that correspond with the book. Through the book study, I'll be sharing practical ways to recognize and root out false allegiances in your own life. Those in the online book club get extra pre-order gifts as well, including a secret podcast episode in which I get vulnerable and share my own false allegiances and how I'm fighting for wholehearted devotion to Jesus. So don't wait. Pre-order your book today and then head over to my website, christinehoover.net, and input your purchase information. This episode is sponsored by The Good Book Company, publishers of The Garden, The Curtain, and The Cross. This beautiful hardback Bible storybook for children aged 3 to 6 takes them on a journey from the Garden of Eden to God's perfect new creation. Children will learn that Jesus breaks down the barrier of sin between us and God so that we can enjoy Him forever. Now available in 2020 is an Easter family devotional. Pick up a copy at thegoodbook.com or wherever good books are sold. I'd also like to thank my sponsor for today's episode, B&H Publishers. Did you hate reading the classics in high school? It's time to rediscover those books we had to read in high school so that they may become beloved books we want to read in adulthood. By providing spoiler-free intros and guides, Karen Swallow Pryor teaches us to read the classics in light of the gospel and to the glory of God. The first two in the series are available March 3rd and include Sense and Sensibility and Heart of Darkness. Learn more at readingandreflecting.com. Friends, I'm thrilled to get to share today's episode of By Faith with you. My guest is Rebecca Bender, and I do want to warn you that this episode is not suitable for children. Because when Rebecca was a teenager, she was tricked by her so-called boyfriend into a life of prostitution in Las Vegas. For 6 years, she was trafficked, bought and sold for money. She became addicted to drugs, and as she talks about today, she also became addicted to the money and material things her trafficker bought her. In our conversation today, Rebecca shares about that life, how she came to faith in Christ, and how her devotion to Christ has broken her of her drug addiction, her love of money, and is now helping her reject shame. She also shares how she's made it her life's mission to share Christ and to help trafficking victims. This is an incredible story that I can't wait for you to hear. Here, friends, is my conversation with Rebecca Bender. Thank you, Rebecca, for joining me on my podcast today.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, I've been really looking forward to talking to you because I just got done reading your memoir. It's called In Pursuit of Love, one woman's journey from trafficked to triumphant. And it's truly a memoir of your life in being sex trafficked as a prostitute in Las Vegas. There's so much I want to ask you, but I just want to jump straight in to hearing straight from you and letting the listeners hear your story. So can we start first just by introducing yourself and where you are currently?
Yeah.
Then we'll go back.
Absolutely. So I'm Rebecca Bender. I'm a mom and a wife, and I'm a seminary grad. I'm a preacher. I live in the Pacific Northwest now. We have 4 beautiful daughters, and I love to write Bible studies, and I love to teach the word. That's what I do today.
That's great. That's great. Yeah. Well, your life it's taken a huge turn. So can we go back and just maybe describe some of your childhood? Because I think your childhood, it made you vulnerable for
where you ended up. So can you tell us a little bit about your growing up years?
Yeah. You know, I think it's so interesting too, when you had opened, you know, when you'd opened up saying that about trafficked into prostitution, I feel like right now human trafficking is such a buzzword. It's trending. Everyone wants to get involved. Everyone wants to help victims. And I'm so grateful. When I learned as a victim that there was this army of people fighting for girls like me, it was so humbling to think that finally someone cared, because you just don't think anybody does. But I think sometimes, because the word human trafficking has been so much of like a buzzword, we really forget to pull that curtain back and go, well, what does that mean? That means that there are young women and sometimes teenagers and sometimes children, like literally in prostitution.
Yes.
Right. And that's not easy to wrap your mind around. It's easier to just call it trafficking and say, we want to help girls. But when you really pull that back and just get real with it, or like, yeah, I was unfortunately forced into prostitution for 6 years. Like, that's a lot of trauma. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of layers and layers of hardenedness and callousness. And, because you have to survive, you have to trust your gut, you have to trust your instincts, you have to be able to make quick decisions on the blink of an eye in order to stay safe. So you really trust your instincts a lot, which later was really great, because I felt like God used this opportunity to show me and teach me more about what discernment is and how we can really harness part of that gut instinct that all human beings have, but also can be enhanced with the Holy Spirit to be able to have more discernment when it's like, no, I shouldn't make that decision, you know, for business, or I shouldn't sign that contract, to just learning to trust that gut. Survivors are really good at. So
how did can you take us back to when you were a teenager? So that word trafficked, I like how you describe it in the book, and maybe you can describe it for us, what that actually means. What is sex trafficking?
Yeah, well, in the legal definition, when we're working cases, which is a lot of what I had been doing for the last 6 years, working with FBI and undercover cops, is we're looking for the use of force, fraud, or coercion at point of recruitment and at point of destination. Those are really the things we look for. The other thing that's important to know is, in order to be trafficked, there has to be some exchange of monetary value for a commercial sex act. So that could be stripping, it can be pornography, it could be as much as private, you know, quote unquote, entertainment. I'd say that very, very loosely. I hope no one's offended. I just didn't know if I'm trying to be thoughtful around word choice and keep it PG. But I think sometimes people only think prostitution, and that's not always true either. If someone's using force to get you to go into a strip club and then is profiting off of your exploitation, that is still considered human trafficking if you wouldn't have done it on your own and if someone else is getting the money. Mm-hmm. So those are the kind of the components we look for. We look for what's the monetary value exchange. And was there force, fraud, or coercion used at point of recruitment and destination? And so when we're working with cops and we're working a case, we actually have to identify those things, find evidence to corroborate that. And sometimes I see the general public will say, oh, she was kidnapped and locked in a room. She's a trafficking survivor. And it's like, unfortunately, she's not actually. She's not legally defined as a trafficking survivor. Kidnapped, sexual servitude, sure, but by law, trafficking has to be an exchange of monetary value. And so if no one is selling that person, then they're being horrifically abused, yes, but it's not trafficking. So you just have to be real careful, I think, around just calling everything trafficking, because it's not.
Uh-huh. So can you take us back to that moment when you were first coerced into a sex act? I mean, you describe in the book that you were in a dating relationship, and how that dating relationship, or what you thought was a dating relationship. Mm-hmm. Can you describe that for us?
Yeah, I was an 80s kid. I grew up being taught stranger danger. I was not taught what to look for when you're dating a con artist, what to look for when your boundaries are being slowly pushed. You know, your personal boundaries of like, I was taught morally not to do this. But what happens when you're being pushed right on the edge of that? And how do you get out of those sticky situations? I was never taught those sort of things. I wasn't taught what to look for if I'm being brainwashed. And those are equally as important. Nowadays, less than 5% of trafficked children are kidnapped. 33% are trafficked by someone they know and trust. Hmm. And 29% are lured off the internet. So when we're talking about protecting our kids, it's not just about stranger danger. It's who do you know and trust? Who's in that circle that has influence on you? And what are you doing online? Have we talked about internet safety? And so many moms that I talk to will say things like, well, I have sons. Or they'll ask, well, what percentage of boys get trafficked? And I think, yes, boys are at risk for exploitation. Absolutely. But I think it's really important to remember that the number one buyer of sex in the world is American men. Hmm. And so how are we raising our sons to not be tempted to look at pornography, to be really thoughtful around online safety? You know what I mean? You pull the layer back, it's way deeper in our cultural influences than just thinking that maybe a kid is being kidnapped at the local grocery store. You know, it's very, it's much different. It's much more complex than that.
So. Yeah. So what was it for you? What happened for you?
You're like, get to the story of you. Sorry to everyone. Teacher mode. Yeah. So I was dating a guy. I was a vulnerable young girl. I had had lots of vulnerabilities in my childhood, even though I was a kind of an average all-American small town girl. I was a cheerleader, varsity athlete. I was, you know, graduated a year early, was accepted into university. Like, no one would have put me in an at-risk youth category at all. But I still had these vulnerabilities. My parents divorced when I was 9. It was a really ugly divorce. My dad started drinking a lot. And there was things in my childhood. My mom started dating a guy that was abusive to her. And so I had witnessed domestic violence for about 2 or 3 years before she finally left him. And it's hard because both of my parents have turned their lives around today, and I'm so grateful for them. But that doesn't negate the couple years of a lot of vulnerable moments in my life. And what it taught me was we keep secrets in this home, right? It taught me that we don't talk about drinking. We hide the alcohol when someone knocks at the door. It taught me that we don't call the police when someone hits you across the face, right? It really solidified some lies. As a young person, about 9 to 12 was when I was having being exposed to these experiences that solidified some untruths in my heart that I grew up with, thinking, oh, we just keep secrets. We just don't talk about it. So by the time, though, I was in high school and a normal kid, I was, you know, I was involved in everything. I had the spirit of adventure, and living in a small town, it's really hard. But I wanted to be a part of stuff. I wanted to love and be loved. And I kind of pursued love in all the wrong places as a girl, not raised, you know, in a real healthy home. I sought boys and attention and parties. And I was the girl that'd be the cheerleader at the football game. And then the first one to crack a beer at a bonfire the later that night, right? It's just, I was just kind of just a party kid, you know, I don't know how else to explain it. But then I ended up getting pregnant, and I had to give up my dorm room and university enrollment to choose to keep my daughter and enroll in local community college and try to put my life together. But I think we have so many young teen moms nowadays that, again, it becomes kind of normalized a little bit. And I think it's really important for us, in order to not judge others, to pull that curtain back for a moment and think about what it's like to be a teen mom. To be alone and scared and not have money, and all of your dreams have kind of changed and have to get shelved, and you're navigating worlds you've never been in, and now you've got a child, and you want the teen mom to really put the child first, but the reality is most 18-year-olds are pretty selfish, right? And we don't always make the best decisions at 18, 19, 20 years old, and you throw a kid in. And it doesn't suddenly put you in a place to make good decisions just because you have a child. And
yeah. And when you had so much responsibility financially to care for her, that you really came to this point where you're like, how am I going to do this?
Right. And having all of those same vulnerabilities of your childhood, the same things of like wanting to have adventure and wanting to be a part of things and wanting to be this party girl. And having all these vulnerabilities of like, we just keep secrets in our home. It's no big deal. You just turn the other cheek when bad things happen and you just ignore it. And so like all of that didn't go away when I suddenly had a baby. I was still, all those things still existed. And now it just got compounded because now you really can't be a part of the things you used to. And now you have to, you have a lot of financial responsibility that you weren't expecting. And so in that moment, in that season in my life, I met a young man who seemed to have all the answers to all my problems. He had a ton of ambition and he had plans to get out of the small town and plans to go accomplish really exciting things in life. He had his own business. He was traveling the country. He was rubbing shoulders with all of these really high-end, you know, like groups and bands. And it was this real exciting adventure that my heart longed for, but I didn't know that it was a trap. I didn't know that it was quicksand and that it wasn't actually going to fulfill the heart that God hadn't put in me to be willing to jump in and try anything. It's easy for me now because when cops are like, hey, Rebecca, can you go on this in this undercover sting with us? I'm like, sure, I'm in, right? And so you see now how God uses that personality for his honor and glory. But when you don't have that and you don't have a mentor, you don't have someone harnessing those gifts in you, they can really be used for harm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he really took advantage of your vulnerability, promised you kind of this grand future. And part of that was he said, I want you to move with me to Las Vegas, you and your daughter. Yeah. So you went.
Yeah, he dated me for 6 months and I thought finally I had this little family. I can remember going to this pizza place. It wasn't called Chuck E. Cheese. It was called something else. And it was like that. And I can remember my daughter jumping in the ball pit and sitting at the table, eating our lunch. And I thought this is it. Like I'm happy. I'm really happy. And you don't realize that you're being tricked, right? Like you don't want to think you're that stupid. You don't want to think you're that naive. You don't want to think it would happen to girls like you. Mm. You want to think you'd be able to identify a bad guy. But that's not always actually true, right? I have four daughters now and I think Frozen is a great example. Like Hans tricked Anna, right? Like he did. He pretended to be someone he was not. He fast-tracked a relationship to get the kingdom. Like, it's a typical example, actually, of not everyone who tries to pretend to be someone they're not is telling the truth. And we have to be more astute and alert and not so trusting. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I mean, you don't want to say that, but it's true nowadays.
So do you think from the very beginning he had very specific intentions that all of it was pretend or?
Absolutely.
Okay.
No, I know for a fact it was all a con. He actually didn't. Come to find out, he didn't have any group signed to his business label. He already had another victim in Vegas being trafficked, and it was her money used of the money selling her was being used to pay for my pizza that day in the pizza shop. And so when that hits you later of like, wait, all of the whining and dining, all of the taking me on vacations, all of the gifts you bought my daughter, all of the lunches, all the dinner, like that was all paid by the sale of someone else.
Hmm.
Wow. That really hit me finding out this was all a trick to you. Like this was all a game to get me here, to seclude me from my family and friends and my support network, to make me completely reliant on you. This was all a big game to you. And I even say this in the book, we get in this big fight and I say, this isn't, it's called the game. That's what the slang word would be in the streets. Like, oh, are you in the game? And cops would say like, are you in the game? And I can remember having this big fight with him and saying, this isn't a game to me. Like, this is my life. This is my daughter's life. This isn't a game. And when you realize that someone's used you as a pawn in a game, it's so hurtful. Mm-hmm. And it really hits you at your core. And I think my heart took hits that took a really long time to come back from.
Oh, I'm sure. So how long after you got to Las Vegas did you how long did it take before you found out? Did he immediately push you into this, or did he play the game a little bit longer?
He immediately took me to an escort service and told me that I needed to sign up. And I fought back a little in terms of like, what do you mean escort? That sounds like prostitution. I'm not okay with that. That's not what I'm into. And he kept pushing more like, no, this isn't prostitution. This is just dancing at private parties and the big fancy suites. This is how Vegas books dancers to rooms. You sign up for these like talent agency, you know, he just kept trying to make it seem as if it was something it wasn't. And even still, when I said, yeah, I'm really not that naive though. Like I escorts prostitution. You can try to paint this any way you want. I'm not that dumb. Even though there may be people that have fallen for lies. So don't want to make anyone feel condemned by that. But that's when he slapped me across the face. First time he had ever been abusive or hurtful. Up until then it had been, you know, everything I'd ever wanted. And so that emotional moment of, well, we're just adults. Like, this is how adults fight. This is how my mom fought, right?
Yeah.
Oh, we're just adults now. Oh, this is just what married people do. But still the emotion of like, wait a minute, this isn't who you've been this whole time. So all of these emotions in the blink of an eye at 19 years old and sitting in Las Vegas at this dead end street. And then it hit me like, I don't know where my baby is. I don't know where my daughter is. I actually don't know my address by heart. Like all the realities started hitting me that I wasn't actually prepared, that I didn't write down my address and give it to a safe person, that I didn't, you know what I mean? Like, cause you don't think it's going to happen to you and you don't realize that it's not just kidnapping. And back then, right, Craigslist wasn't around. Cell phones weren't really super big. It was like StarTax and Razors, you know, like it wasn't like we have today. I think one of the things that's been great with the advancement of technology is I think most of us nowadays have been able to say like, hey, before I go pick up a couch at some stranger's random house on Craigslist, I should probably leave the address with someone, right? Like most of us think that way nowadays, but this long ago, this was what, 19 years ago?
Yeah.
You didn't think like that because we didn't have things that made us more aware that there was danger when you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. Because you mentioned that you didn't know where your daughter was because in the book, you describe this scene of that he's taking you out. So you left your daughter with his brother as a babysitter and he's taking you out on the town in your new place. But In reality, he was taking you to sign up for this escort service. So in that moment, he hits you. You have this moment of realization that your daughter is in this new house that you just moved in. You don't know where you are, and you're in this decision point of how am I going to respond and get back to my daughter.
Right. Exactly. I think, you know, when you have to make decisions in the blink of an eye, a lot of people are like, I would have done this or I would have done that. And you actually don't know. You don't know what you would do in the blink of a moment of what feels like life or death. I have a friend who's also a survivor and she tells her story, which I just think is brilliant. She says she's in the car with him and she thinks at the next red light, I'm going to jump out. And because that's what we all think from watching movies, just jump out of the vehicle at the red light. She said, but no light ever turned red. They were all green. And within three lights, we got to the house. And so I think it's really easy for us to all make assumptions of like, oh, what would I have done? But not every scenario plays out like the movies. It's not, what if you don't get a red light? And what if you end up at the house within a few blocks? Like, you don't have a whole 15 minutes to make a plan. Like you have 2 minutes and
you're trying to survive. It was like this, I've got to survive. I've got to get back to my daughter. What do I need to do? And so you went through with it. You went inside, you signed up for the escort service.
I complied out of fear. It's usually how I like to word that. I complied. Was it the same decision I'd make in hindsight? Probably not. If you know what's going to happen, then you have an opportunity to make better informed decisions. But I wanted to get back to my daughter. I wanted to get back to that place of being really happy and just hopeful. I wanted to trust and believe him that the man I loved told me it would just be dancing and that he'd be there to keep me safe, right? Really, he was there as a bodyguard. He was there as like a monitor to make sure that I complied, right? And so I went inside. And the fascinating part that I remember when I went inside was they give you all this paperwork you have to fill out. And it's kind of like a ton of legal jargon and small print like you'd see on a medical form when you go to the doctor's office, you know, and you have to initial every single like line. Hmm. And I remember kind of like vaguely looking at it, no big deal. You know, you're just kind of skimming it. Let's be honest. We all do that with these long medical forms, right? And so as I'm doing that, the lady says to me, it just says that you're not going to have sex. We don't hire girls like that. And I thought, oh, I can trust him. See, everyone's telling me this isn't going to be prostitution. Everyone's telling me this is just escorting in regards, like they call it an escort service, but you're really just like a background dancer in a music video. Like you're just, you know, bikini at a pool dancing around, no big deal. Everyone's telling me that. And so maybe part of you is like, well, I'm from this really tiny farm town. Like maybe I've been naive. Maybe I just don't know how it works in this industry. And he's smart and clearly has this big business. So I should just trust him. And the paperwork is like solidifying his lie. So I kept complying. Do you know what I mean? Like I kept going down the rabbit hole because everything seemed, you know, somewhat trustworthy. I mean, a little shady. You're getting a little bit of those checks in your gut. Like, oh, I don't know, but you just keep pressing through and you think
it to yourself.
You justify it. And I think I just really need to get home. I just want to get home to my daughter. I'm gonna get the money back for the move that he told me that I'd only have to do this until we got the money back. And then I'd get home and things would be better tomorrow. Things would just go back to normal tomorrow. I could just forget that today happened tomorrow. But tomorrow like doesn't come. Mm-mm. And that's when you start realizing I'm trapped. Like tomorrow's not coming. And that's when you do start running. When people say, why didn't you just run? 6 years is a long time. My answer is I did run. That's why I'm sitting here today. But I did have multiple attempted escapes and you learn what to do better with each attempt. I learned where to hide money next time. I learned where to roll up jeans for next time. I learned that you can't buy a plane ticket post 9/11 with cash, right? And your trafficker doesn't generally leave you a debit card. So I learned that I got all the way to the airport and I couldn't buy a plane ticket for me and my little girl.
Wow.
And I thought, I don't know what to do. Like I did try to run, but they weren't all successful. Yeah. And some were. And I do describe in the book running and getting home and him showing up in Oregon in my tiny farm town and me realizing like, I'm not safe anywhere.
Yeah.
And my family is really at risk. And I remember thinking like, just don't hurt anybody. Don't cause a scene. Don't hurt my mom. I'll just come home. Just don't hurt anyone. And you start to live in this place of so much fear and abuse because him threatening to hurt me wasn't just threats. Like he actually would, you know?
And yes,
I can remember him pulling me out. And not this trafficker. I ended up getting sold into multiple traffickers. So this one I'm describing now is not the guy who pretended to be my boyfriend, but I can remember him pulling me out in front of our entire, like the home of other trafficked girls and him beating me in front of them and saying, this one has a spirit that won't be broken. And I can remember feeling so embarrassed by that in that moment. I was ashamed that I wouldn't comply, that I wouldn't, I don't know why that sounds probably really bizarre, but I think in the moment, I remember just feeling embarrassed that I was the only one that kept getting hurt. And now that I'm healed and I have done so much work to work on my trauma, I'm really like, I'm proud today to say, you're darn right. I had a spirit that wouldn't be broken. And I still do. Yes. And I still refuse to bend and be that girl that the enemy wants to try to keep quiet and keep her mouth shut and try to have her shrink back to be less than. I will tell my story because I believe it will change culture. And I think we all have a story to tell that can change culture and change legacy in our communities And I want all women to not shrink back and to have spirits that won't be broken. And that's my fight today.
Yeah. And I can see the passion. And I wish everybody could see you as you're talking. I can see you and just the passion in your eyes. This is God's ministry he has given you through this. I would love to hear how you came to know the Lord, because at that time that you were first trafficked, and then you mentioned there were actually several men that you were trafficked by. Mm-hmm. The second one, I think it was after the second one that you, was it? No, it was after the first one that you, because you were involved in this, and you were controlled. I think that's one of the things I'm glad you mentioned that, because there was so much control that I don't think I understood went into this kind of thing. You really were stalked and controlled in every aspect of your life. And you started to turn to drugs and you became addicted to drugs. And it was through that you tell us, I'm saying your story for you, but tell us about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think what you're saying is important, because everyone envisions kidnapped and chained and locked to a radiator and duct taped and all this stuff. The reality is that doesn't sell, right? Sex sells in America, and it has to be, that doesn't sell. And so traffickers have to figure out other ways to keep you in mental chains in order to make you obey the rules. And this isn't what's people, you know, I work now with so much law enforcement, and you come across so much evidence that I think the general public just doesn't get of, I mean, traffickers have blogs and forums that you can have accounts on where they teach each other tactics for, there's a whole article that a trafficker wrote called How to Use Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs to Keep Women in Mental Chains, wrote an article on it. Traffickers have written books on how to manipulate and brainwash women, and they self-publish them on Amazon. And they'll go sometimes years before Amazon gets informed or anyone catches on, you know, because you don't necessarily look at content. And we have freedom of speech laws. So, right, you're not wanting people to come in and review every detail that people are trying to self-publish. But the reality is there's a big industry that they teach each other some of these tactics. This isn't just some guy trying to figure it out. Like they're helping, it's an industry. It's a criminal industry.
Yes.
And so I started using drugs. I got really addicted to drugs by the time I was 21. I was a full-blown addict. I was down to 95 pounds. You could see my spine and my hips, and I mean, just full-blown addict. I never thought, we all have these moments of denial. I think a lot of us know about addiction and denial, right? And so in my mind, I thought, I'm not an addict because it's cocaine. I'm not an addict because my daughter is still at that, I can still pay all the bills, or he's technically paying all the bills, right? I thought addicts shoot needles, but addicts don't, you know. And it wasn't until my dealer was out of town and I ended up having to maintain my high, I had to use crack for the first time. And I remember smoking crack in the floorboard of a car, and it hit me like, I'm an addict. I'm an actual addict at this point. Like, I can't function without being high. And he would try to monitor my drug use. He would buy drugs and bring them to me and try to monitor that. And so after my mom showed up in Las Vegas and took my daughter, and everyone just thought, you know, I was on drugs. Like, no one thinks human trafficking. No one looks at the root of why people start using drugs, right? And they just see the addict, and they don't necessarily see what happened that got you here. Like, what happened that made you want to mask your emotions so bad?
Yeah.
And so my mom flew to Vegas and took my daughter from me and said, you're not going to get her back till you turn your life around. And I went to a real low at that time and tried to commit suicide twice, actually. And then that's when it hit me. Like, I have to turn my life around if I'm going to get my daughter back. She was the most important thing in my life, which sounds bad when you hear this young mom making all these bad decisions. Like, really, if she was that important, why would you make all these decisions? And really, at the root of my heart, I just wanted her to have a family that I never had. I wanted her to have a dad that loved her, and he pretended to. And I wanted her to always never be without, which I can remember feeling when my mom left my dad. And then when she left her boyfriend, having these moments of not being able to eat, having moments of saying, mom, I'm hungry. And her saying, I don't get paid for two more days. You're going to have to eat at school. Those were real moments that made me say, I just don't ever want my daughter to live like that. So I'll put up with, and I'll justify, and I'll ignore, and I'll desensitize so that she can feel normal. And so when I didn't have her, it felt like, what's the point, you know?
Friends, I know you're enjoying this conversation with Rebecca, but I do want to stop and tell you a little bit more about my new book, With All Your Heart. I wrote this book because I know joy can be yours, and then it comes through allegiance. Our hearts were made for unswaying allegiance to a king and a kingdom, a concept that Jesus talked about more than any other. Yet every day, the false kings of anxiety, approval, comfort, image, escape, power, material possessions, self-sufficiency, and many others plot to reign over our hearts instead. Their lies about the true king are so subtle and insidious that we rarely recognize them. And so we go on living with divided loyalties that stall our spiritual growth and infect our relationships. If you want to find freedom from the forces vying for your heart, I want to equip you for the fight. In this heart check kind of book, I want to help you root out your own misplaced allegiances so that you can live wholly as a subject of the King who made and redeemed you. Find out more at the link in the show notes or on my website, christinehoover.net. Okay, now back to the show.
And so thankfully, my mom gave me a list of rehabs, and there was one Christian rehab on the list. And I said, I ain't going to no Christian rehab. These Christians ain't got a clue what life on the streets is like. That's what I remember telling her. I ain't going to no rehab. I'm going to tell these church ladies that I'm a prostitute and a drug addict. What are they? I'm going to make them cry. I'm going to scare them. That's what I told her. And she was like, Becky, you have to turn your life around if you want your daughter back. And so I called every other place but the Christian place. And nowhere had vacancy. No vacancy, no vacancy, no vacancy. And finally, I called the Christian rehab, and they said, we have one bed left and we'll save it for 24 hours. And I thought, all right, if there's a God out there, if my praying grandma that took me to vacation Bible school when I was a little girl, if she's right, then God will make a way. And I got there and I was met by the most incredible people who just loved me regardless of my past. And they didn't try to be Holy Spirit and like convict me. They just loved me, and they let the Holy Spirit do his job. They let the light push out the dark over time. They didn't expect me to be a new creation day one. You don't get saved and get amnesia. It's not bibbidi bobbidi boo, fairy godmother, you're this new. It doesn't work like that when you come out of really extreme lifestyles like I had been in. It will be a process, and you have to love people during their backbiting, during their gossip, during their manipulation, during their seduction, those were deep-rooted character traits. Yeah. That the enemy had the world, all of it. Like I had bad character. I still have things I work on. Shoot, who doesn't?
I know. Who doesn't? When you said it, I'm like, yeah, me too.
I just the other day, I'm like, I need to call a therapist. I got some issues, man. Still, I got some major issues still.
Yeah. But, so you became a Christian in rehab, and God saved you from this drug addiction miraculously. And then you move home, you get your daughter back and all of that. And this is what I really want. I want us to talk about this, because you do describe in the book that it was this long process, because you suddenly you're trying to leave the game, as you call it, as the slang word for it. And you get home and you're so poor. You cannot make ends meet because you have a record. You've been arrested for prostitution. Mm-hmm. And you talk about that you were thinking about the money that you made. And that money really was luring you back to kind of get back into the game. So can you describe that, kind of that, the pool of money?
Yeah. Money is, I mean, we all know that the love of money is the root of all evil, right? And so I think as someone who had addictive behaviors anyway, I became very much money was like my heroin, right? And Even though I never got to keep a dollar, my trafficker would strip search you and take every single dollar you made if you didn't give it willingly. Sometimes he wouldn't strip search you every single night. It would be random strip searches, like you're at the feds or raiding your home or something. But because of that, you're always living in fear because you don't know if today would be the day that he finds the $20 that you slip aside, or what they call stacking money. So you just never know. And so you know how much money has passed through your hands, even though you couldn't keep it all. And the enemy was so good. When I'm living in poverty, I'm living in a transitional house, I've got bunk bed with my daughter and another roommate in one bedroom, right? Like, I'm riding the public bus, I'm putting quarters in Ziploc baggies and taking my laundry on my laundry basket on my lap on the public. But people don't live in poverty and have never lived in poverty. Like, it's over half of America. I don't know the exact stats, but I mean, a lot of people live below the poverty line in our country. And it is a real, real concern of when you cannot afford food, when you cannot afford a vehicle or insurance or gas, that it's like the public bus takes so much of your time because you have to change so often. And it's like what would take you 15 minutes to get to work takes someone in poverty an hour and a half. And so then it's like really hard to keep getting ahead and getting right. Cause it's using up all your time. You're putting a little bit of money aside and then something happens. You got to copay at a doctor, your kid's sick, you have to go to urgent care. And it's like, it's this never ending hamster wheel that's really hard to get out of. And I can remember walking by Starbucks and smelling coffee. And I remember the voice of the enemy. I remember him saying so clearly, "Is this how good your God is that you can't afford a cup of coffee? This is what God has for you. This is the promise." And I remember feeling like partnering with that lie. I remember saying, "You're right. Is this God isn't good. You're right. God's holding out on me. You're right. He doesn't have anything good for me. His promises are taking too long. So I don't know if God's a truth teller." You know, all of those same feelings and lies that we've heard all through scripture that Eve believed, right? But like when you don't know, when you're such a new Christian and you don't necessarily have the strength and you don't know how to fight, you just don't know. And it's so easy to fall for the warfare, to fall in warfare. I mean, it's just, it's horrible. And yeah. So I went back to a life of prostitution, because of these mental chains, because of wanting to be back with my quote unquote boyfriend who had convinced me that it was only the drugs of why all of that was taking place. It was never because he was tricking me or forcing me. It was all my fault. I was the addict. And as much as we victim blame, we self blame. And I took the blame. I owned it. And I'm like, yep, you're right. It was because of me. So if I don't use drugs, then maybe we'll be back to being that happy family at the ball pit that day. And so I went back thinking, now that I'm clean and I'll tell them about Jesus and we'll all go to church and things will go back to being that hopeful dream that my heart had really longed for. But
instead you got deeper into it. This was when the third trafficker came in, and that really became this ingrained. This is a really interesting part of your story because it was a counterfeit family that you talk about, where your trafficker had multiple women. You were all living in a home together. And it felt like this family to you. You really enjoyed the other women. You became friends with them, but it was this counterfeit family. So can you describe that kind of time? And also, now that you've become a Christian, but you're here in this life, did you feel kind of this pull back and forth? Was there kind of this wrestling inside of you?
Yeah. I mean, I think what's fascinating when I look back and look at the nearly 6 years that I was in this, half of it is this back and forth with this guy I think I'm in love with, who's just tricking me, right? Mm-hmm. And me like struggling of like, are you tricking me or is it my fault? And I don't know what's going on, but I'm really in love and I don't want to lose my family, da, 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 da. And then it gets seven times worse. And I have to make this like, I don't know how to get out of this anymore. I'm in so deep that I feel like a normal world is so far away. I don't even know how to be normal anymore. It felt so far removed. And And I was trying to figure out a way out. And I get recruited. That's the term we would use that traffickers use all, are the ones that create all the lingo, which I think is fitting, side note. But anyway, so I get, I end up getting involved in this other crime family that's going to be my sense of protection to leave the other group, right? And I detail this in the book. It's like, you can't join a gang. You can't join the MS-13 and then go, you know what, guys? I think I'm a little bit in over my head. I'm going to go ahead and go home, but thanks so much for letting me try this out. Like, this was so fun. Really, I'm not going to tell anyone. Pinky promise. Take care. It doesn't work like that, you guys. Like, this is organized crime. These are people who have done things that would put them in prison for life. So they're not letting those who have the opportunity to snitch just walk away. It doesn't work like that. And so it feels like your only opportunity sometimes is to switch gangs, for lack of better words. Yeah. Have the protection of another gang from the first gang, and this one is going to be the way that they'll help you get out of the gang. You know, like, that's in your brain. You're just still trying to survive. You're trying to figure out how to get out of this. And this feels like the lesser of two evils to get protection from one. And so I join this family. I get recruited to join this family. We call it a family, quote unquote. That's like the slang. I'm not actually thinking it's a family, but that's what you call it. And there's other women. There's three other women there. And they become, one of them specifically, she becomes my very, very best friend. And I was actually in this home longer than I was ever in anywhere else. I'm there for almost 3 years, and they became my family. There's another little boy in the house, and him and my daughter were very close. And, you know, I get triggered more when I watch things like Sister Wives on polygamy, because that's very much how we lived. And you're all kind of Stockholm syndrome in love, trauma bonded with the captor, the Haiken cult leader. But really it's about kind of keeping the money coming into the pot, and, you know, the one pot that pays for the whole family. And it's very much like a cult. It's very much how you would live in a compound.
Very controlled.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very controlled.
And I think
you had to be with a wife-in-law or with him, usually at all times. You'd have given 45 minutes to go to the grocery store. You would be timed and beaten if you didn't come back within that set amount of time. You had to ask permission to buy Christmas presents, and you were given a budget. You'd have to turn in every single dollar in a very neat order, very OCD. Has to be, the green circle would have to be on top, face up, all of it lined, sat, you know, in a nice, neat stat. I mean, very, very controlled.
Yes.
And that really affects your mental psyche when you live in that kind of environment for so long. But I think what it did for me was it did give me this sense of family of, I can't leave these women. Even if I had an opportunity to run, I would think, I can't leave this little boy without a mama. I can't leave my wife-in-law if she's, you know, in prison and she's doing all the feds ended up raiding our home in 06, and two of the women went to prison for tax evasion because our trafficker put things in their names, not his. And that's when it really was hard to run, because I felt like I would be disloyal to my wife-in-laws if I left.
Yeah. There's so many factors to why it seems, from reading your book, why women don't run, why they don't leave. And can you explain that? And then what made you leave finally?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is what I'd hoped with the book. So many people ask, why don't you just run? Why don't the girls just run? That's the number one question we get from everybody. And so we played around with even naming it, Why Doesn't She Just Run? Or, you know, the title was really hard for us to come up with, because it's this mix of like gritty true crime meets a story of faith and redemption. And so like a redemptive title is really easy to come up with, but then you don't really understand. This is over half the book is a gritty true crime novel, right?
Right.
And if we went too gritty true crime, our readers wouldn't know this is a faith-based book. We didn't want people to feel like they were being tricked into reading a gritty true crime and it's all about Jesus at the end, you know? Uh-huh. So it was really hard for us to find a title. We took months and months actually to come up with the one we have now. And even still, we're like, it'll work.
It works.
Thankfully, you know, in one one afternoon, we'd had this horrible incident happened, and I called my aunt who worked at a domestic violence shelter, and I told her what had happened, and she tried to, you know, she took off her aunt hat and put on domestic violence advocate hat, and she started coming up with an escape route and a safe word and kind of going through like she would for any woman who's trying to run from a domestic violence situation. And I remember I thought I called her from my car. This is so interesting how trauma in the brain works. I thought I called her from my car. I remember being in my car when no one was around so I could talk safely. And recently when writing the book, I was, you know, confirming with lots of different people, trying to just make sure I'm getting the timeline right, because your brain is, you know, memories are hard to remember in general, let alone you have trauma involved in it. And she would say, no, you didn't call me from your car. You were hiding in the closet. I was like, really? She's like, no, you told me, like, you were whispering, like, I can only talk for a few minutes. I'm hiding in the closet. I thought, man, I don't even remember that. I thought it was a car. So it's just weird how the brain works. But thankfully, he had taken a plea deal on a tax evasion charge, and I knew he had a self-surrender date coming up, so he wouldn't be able to chase me again. And as soon as he got on the plane he was flying home to tell his mom that he was going to prison. He wanted to tell her in person for not paying his taxes, was what he told her. Which is true, technically. I mean, that it was the technical charge. So okay. I remember waiting till he was on the plane and calling to see if he answered his phone. You know, when you're on the plane, your phone goes right to voicemail. And so he called me from the airport, and I can remember not really what he was talking about, but I can remember deeply trying to make sure I could hear airport sounds.
Yes.
Because he would trick you so much, and he would tell you he was one place and then he'd randomly be at the place you were at. And so you never knew. I always felt like I was being watched.
Yeah.
And so I remember listening intently for those airport noises, and I heard gate announcements. And so I waited until a few minutes, 15:30, I don't remember exactly, but after this supposed departure time, and I remember calling and getting the voicemail, and I was like, this is it, go, go, go. And I just yelled for my daughter, pack your favorite toy right now. We have to leave right now. And I can remember her being so sad, like, but I want all my toys, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think those are the moments that are hard, that people, you just think, why don't you just run? And you're like, you're not having to stand there looking at a 7-year-old little girl in the face, telling her why she can't bring any of her things, why she has to leave this brother that she spent the last 3 years with, why she has to leave all of her friends from school in a way that she would understand at 7. Like, you're not there in that moment. You don't know that fear and that heartache. And sometimes it's easier to say, I'll just stay one more week and try to give myself a little bit more time to figure it out.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's easier to do that than face those really difficult moments. But I knew I had to run. I knew I could not live like this one more day. I felt like I'm going to die here. Or something's going to happen to my little girl that I can't undo. And so because I loved her so much, I was started to really like, I have to do this for her. She cannot be raised any. I thought by now I would have been out of this, you know?
Yeah.
And the years go by so fast, and the next thing you know, they're 7. And anyone who has kids knows that feeling. Mm-hmm. Like, gosh, how did that, feels like I blink and she turned 10. And you're like, yeah, that's like that when you're being trafficked too.
Yeah. Yeah.
And traffic doesn't take away the normal humanity of just being a normal mom when time goes by quick, you know, like,
yeah.
So I ran.
You ran. I'm so glad you did. When I got to that part in the book, I'm like, yes, finally, even though there were a few more bumps in the road.
Definitely a lot more.
Yeah. But eventually you came to a place of stability apart from the game. And I would love to hear about that. And just what was the difference that time when you finally were like, I am done with this?
I think really allowing the Lord, I felt like God, when I finally got out, and I had already met, you know, I'd already met Jesus and got saved and had been delivered from drug addiction, but it wasn't really rooted in me. It was like, you know, when I finally said, okay, God, I can't do this. Clearly, I don't know how to do this. Like, I got some issues. I think when I finally was able to look at myself and say, Not that I would ever victim blame any woman for anything that's happened to them. It doesn't matter if you were fast and a party girl. No one has the right to traffic you. It doesn't matter if you made one bad decision. No one has the right to beat you up, right? Like, I would never victim blame by any means. But it took me to say, I have come out of a fire smelling like smoke. And I'm going to be okay with facing the fact that I smell like smoke, instead of just continuing to wear the smoke-infested clothes and going, well, you just don't know what I've been through. It's okay that I look like this and act like this and have behaviors like this. But you don't have to. Mm-hmm. You don't have to smell like that anymore. You can change. And I think it took me really facing that reality of, I've got some issues. And it's okay to admit that. It's okay to say, I have some character that needs some work. And if I don't face this addiction to money, if I don't face the fact that I'm really afraid to live in poverty again, if I don't face some of these really deep wounds of learning that it's okay to lie about where you're at, if I don't face these, I will stay in this cycle of generational poverty and abuse and addiction for the rest of my life. And that's when it really started saying, okay, come what may, I got to figure this out. And it was really the voice of God that started making me have those aha moments. It was Him saying, millions of people do this, do life without selling themselves. You can too. Mm-hmm. And yes, you might have to get in on HUD. And yes, you might have to get on food stamps, but you can do this. It was Him telling me that. That was like, okay, I'm going to start taking a budgeting class because I actually don't know how to budget money. I just know I have to hit the track when the sun goes down, and when my behind comes back in that door, my trafficker pays all the bills. That's been my money management plan for 6 years. That's not normal. Mm-hmm. And so learning, like taking that hard look at my own vulnerabilities and roots and all of it that made me start seeking therapy and seeking prayer and just really facing, like, I have to change.
Yeah.
To change.
And you also, I like that the book is called In Pursuit of Love. I don't know if you love the title, but I like
it. I do. I do now. It's grown. Okay, good. On just took us a while to get there.
I think that, you know, and I'm just meeting you, so I could be wrong, but it seems like that there were two primary routes that kept leading you back. And one was money, which we've kind of talked about. And one was your desire to be loved. And we all have that, but you wanted that family. You wanted that sense of belonging and acceptance and unconditional love. And that also was drawing you back into the game. And so it seems like at that time when you came out, you really had to come to grips with, if I just have the Lord, that's all I need. And there was this wrestling to submit to that and to be, it's okay to be lonely, or it's okay to be on my own. It's okay to not have money because this is where I want to be. That's what I saw out of your story.
Yeah. Pursuing my relationship with God with all the tenacity that I had pursued everything else with, coming to that moment of, like, I had a pastor in rehab once do a sermon, and I'll still remember it to this day. He said, when your plate of drugs would fall in the carpet and you get on your hands and knees to pull that tiny little rock of dope out, that's the same type of tenacity you have to go after Jesus with. Wow. That I will get on my hands and knees and I will dig like a crazy person. I have to feel like I belong with Him. And that if everything is stripped away and I have nothing, if I have to quit my job and move out of my home, will I still serve Him? Will I still truly love Him and really allow Him to be the Lord in my life over everything? Will I, right? Like that kind of pursuit, I had to be really okay with, like, all right, I'm in. Like, it can't be no worse than anything I've been through. That's what I remember saying. I mean, I've been to jail a lot. I've had my face broken in 5 places. I've been tattooed. Two men have tattooed their names on my back to show ownership. I've been stripped down by the police. Like, I've been through a lot.
Yeah.
I have been homeless. I've slept on couches. I've been hungry. Nothing can be worse. If going after the call of God leads to that, then we all got a problem. And the Lord reminded me of that when He said, if you give me the same amount of time that you gave the enemy, I will never be outdone. And I thought, okay, then you got 6 years. And if it's back to all this same crap I'm in right now, then I don't want it then.
Yeah.
And the Lord, and I think being just very real with God and saying like, all right, I'll give it a shot and I'll do that. I'll do 6 years. But man, it's got to get better than this because this is bad too. And this is really hard too. Like living in poverty is really, really hard. Mm-hmm. And being hopeless and not knowing what you're going to do with the rest of your life. Like, am I just going to work a minimum wage job and be on food stamps the rest of my life? Like, is that what God has? And he really showed up at about year two. But it took a lot of work. And
yeah.
I think we all are such this microwave society of like quick, easy access to information at the blink of a Google button, you know, microwave dinners. We're forgetting that in reality, the acorn has in it an oak tree that will take decades to create. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of life that you is realistic with Jesus. It's not going to be a microwave faith. It is an oak tree kind of faith. And being willing to put in the time and effort and energy to build that and know that you have that in you, that just takes time. And I think I had to become really okay with that.
Yeah. And through all this, I love you can see how God has formed your personality for the ministry he has for you. So he's combined who you are and your tenacity with your story. And he's given you this incredible ministry because now your work is working. You work with trafficking victims. You work with law enforcement. Can you tell us what you're doing now?
Yeah. Well, for a long time, I started my ministry. We help law enforcement officers. We train cops, FBI agents, and undercover police, patrol, any kind of emergency first responder, which includes emergency room staff in hospitals, domestic violence responder, you know, any type of crisis response. So we train them on what domestic exploitation looks like. And over time, that's really grown. And I've learned a lot working with my cop friends. And now we get to work cases where we're actually, combing evidence, writing reports for the prosecuting attorney, actually taking the stand, testifying during trials as a human trafficking expert, just like a blood splatter expert would be considered, assisting with ensuring bad guys are put away for a really long time and bringing justice and redemption to the women and children that have been hurt. And then I wanted other women to also know that their stories mattered. And so we started this online school for survivors of human trafficking to have a mentor that they could figure out their now what. What are you going to do with the rest of your life, regardless of where they lived? Because living in a small farm town, there's not a lot of resources. And so I was finishing my degree online, and that's when I felt like the Lord just had this aha moment. I thought if I can get a master's online, I could mentor online. And so we created this online school. More recently, though, because of my degree, graduating seminary with my master's in biblical Christian theology with concentration in biblical studies, I think that God has another thing in the next 10 years for me. Like I've been out 10 years from a life of traffic, actually 11 this month. It'll be 11 years.
That's great.
Mm-hmm. And I'm excited to see what the next 10 years holds. If God's done all that, and let alone six, he did a ton in 10. I love the word of God. It's the one thing that sustained me and changed my life. And so I want all women, not just trafficked women now, but I want all women to know that their story matters, that redemption is possible for everyone, that everybody has an oak tree in them, that I want everyone to know they have a spirit that won't be broken. And when you partner with God and you really let him do his work, that sky's the limit for what he has for you. Mm-hmm. And so we've been doing a lot more women's conferences and church events. And hopefully we'll have a couple more Bible studies coming out in case our publisher's listening. So, I mean, they know. I obviously talk to them all the time about, my Bible study, my next Bible study, you know. But that's really my heart. And so I've loved working in the movement. It's been incredible. I love the anti-trafficking movement. I love helping cops and women. And it will always be my testimony and my story. But we'll see. If anyone's here has women's events, visit our website. We'd love to come share our testimony of redemption.
Well, just to close, I'm thinking of listeners who, there may be women who can relate to your story, but everybody can relate to a past that. And I don't know, do you struggle with shame over some of the decisions that you made? And if so, what would you say to women who are listening who they just are dealing with shame? They're having trouble releasing shame. They know Christ, but they also can't get past what the things that they've done or have been done to them. What would you say to those women who are listening?
Such a good question. You know, for a long time, I didn't actually struggle with shame until more recently in my life. For a long time, I think maybe it's just being a part of the anti-trafficking movement where we're really, really dedicated to not to letting the victim know it's not their fault, right? It's not your fault that you were trafficked. I don't care what you did. I don't care where you come from. I don't care if you wore a mini skirt that night and became a stripper. It's still not okay for someone to beat you and sell you and take all of the money. It doesn't matter that you were a party girl or a fast young thing, like, girl, put me in. I know how that feels. It still isn't okay. Right. And so I've lived in that space for so long that I never felt a lot of shame until this year when we started getting ready to release the book. And shame still just grips me, especially with this book coming out. It's like, I'm afraid people are going to judge me. You know, I got contracted to write the book at like 60,000 words and I turned in 90 and they were like, oh, we're going to have to like cut half of your story. And I'm like, but then people wait, but they won't understand. And and they're like, your readers are smart. They're going to understand, but it's still so scary.
Yeah.
You know, when you read it out loud, I did the audio recording and I hung up and I just called my support system. So I would encourage women to get a really good support system of people who will remind you of your goodness. Because I can remember reading my audiobook literally just last month and leaving. And I called my best friend in tears and I was like, I just sound like a slut. Like, I just sound like a total slut. And that's when she was like, it doesn't matter if you were. It doesn't matter. It doesn't give someone the right to beat you and sell you. And so I just want to encourage people, like, I still struggle. Like, I still struggle even just, you know, clearly I'm emotional even talking about it now. Like, and we're all going to get through it. If you struggle with it, it's just the enemy. He wants to keep you silent. He wants to keep you from telling your story because stories matter. They matter to God. Revelations tells us that many will overcome by the blood of the Lamb and the word of our testimony. It's so important to God. He includes it with the blood of the Lamb. It's important. It changes your children. It's going to change your relationships. It's going to change your community. Stories matter. And so whatever shame you're feeling, that's the enemy trying to silence you. And so don't listen. Call your support system. Remind yourself what the word of God says and keep moving forward. Even if you're like, well, I'm putting it all out there. Too late now. I can't take it back. The book's coming out January 28th.
That's right.
Well, and so like, just keep going. Just keep pressing forward.
I think you're exactly right that shame is meant to silence us. And I am so glad that you didn't remain silent, that you have shared your story with us. First of all, it is a window into a world that I did not understand and know. And so I have learned things that I needed to learn, but also to see God's redemption, where he can go in his power with his grace. It's a reminder to me of how he has saved me as well. And we have different stories, but this book is powerful. And so I'm thankful that you didn't remain silent, that you have written it for us. And so I'm thankful. I'm thankful for you sharing your story with us today. I can't imagine what it's like to rehash that over and over and over, but I'm thankful you're doing it. It's going to impact people when they read this story. So thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you. Thanks everyone for listening to my story and taking the time to hear my heart. And I hope it's been helpful in some way for each and every person that's listening. Mm-hmm.
I definitely would recommend everyone listening to get the book because I think we've just been able to kind of dig just a little bit into it. There's so much more to the story. And I think to understand it and to understand where Rebecca is coming from and some of the things she was just able to touch on, you really need to read the book to get it all. So it's called In Pursuit of Love. It's by Rebecca Bender, and I know you're going to love it, so grab it. Thanks, Rebecca.
Thanks so much.
After we finished recording, Rebecca let me know about a great resource that I'd like to pass along to you. It's called Find Your Lane, and it's a tool that helps you discover how you can get involved in the fight against sex trafficking in the United States. I'm going to put a link to that in the show notes for you, and I also can't say enough about Rebecca's book. It's called In Pursuit of Love, and it's a much deeper look into the story that she shared today. Okay, friends, join me next week as I talk with Heather Creekmore. Heather shared with me about her battle with comparison and body image, and she touches on everything from social media to how she herself continues to battle in the area of comparison. Until then, friends, have a great week and keep walking forward by faith.